It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Coming up, we'll look at the iOS 0 days and the patch to fix them. An issue with RDP that Microsoft says, yeah, it's not a high priority to fix that. And issues with OpenOffice, LibreOffice, and Russia's plans to disconnect from the internet. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 701, recorded Tuesday, February 12th, 2019. Adiantum. Security Now is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. And by IT Pro TV, binge-worthy, flexible, and affordable IT training. Go to go.itpro.tv/securitynow to take advantage of their biggest sale yet. Standard memberships, just $29 a month. For an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription, use the code SN30 at checkout. And by Sophos Cybersecurity. In an age of evolving cyber threats, you need evolved cybersecurity. Powered by artificial intelligence, Sophos can detect threats before they strike, killing ransomware, viruses, and other cyber threats dead in their tracks. Get a free security scan or a free trial today at Sophos.com. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with the Commander-in-Chief of the Privacy Brigade, Mr. Stephen Gibson.
The privacy. Every week it changes. Yeah. Leo. That's, I never know what you're going to come up with. It's always fun.
You should see the uniform. It's all lead foil. It's fabulous. Fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little heavy to wear if you get the thick version of that.
Well, I was reading the tin foil actually conducts and probably is not ideal for a hat.
Well, if you, as long as you didn't have any open seams, it'd be essentially a Faraday cage, so nothing could get in. But if you have it, you know, if you just like a little cap on top, that's just not going to do the job.
That's what I said. The entire uniform.
This episode is titled Adiantum, which is a new term that Google has coined. And it allows me to use the phrase "Google does the cha-cha" for reasons we will be getting to.
Okay,
some very, very cool technology, and yeah, as we know, oftentimes they're among the news of the week. Nothing really stands out. This time, last Thursday, Google announced something which is significant for our industry. So, Adiantum is its name. But first, we're going to look at Apple's most recent 12.1.4 iOS update and the 2 0-day vulnerabilities it closed, in addition to fixing the FaceTime problem. Also, a very worrisome new Android image display vulnerability involving PNG files, which makes stage fright probably look like nothing by comparison. This is not good. We're also going to do a bit of a dive into the research into a reverse RDP attack. We've talked about the remote desktop protocol and how bad it is for people to leave their RDP servers exposed to the public internet. Well, turns out you need to trust the server you're connecting to every bit as much. So that was some really interesting research that Checkpoint did. Also, there's a problem with LibreOffice and OpenOffice, which one of the two has been fixed. But until it is, it's raising all kinds of alarm bells. I wanted to share quickly Mary Jo's early peek at enterprise pricing for extended Windows 7 support, which you guys talked about last week on This Week in Windows. Also, China and Russia are both continuing their work to take control of their own country's internet. We'll touch on what that's about. We've got Firefox's resumption of its AV warning. Remember that they had a problem we talked about last week because it was causing such problems for AV, they've resumed releasing Firefox 65 as a consequence of some changes. I have a few more squirrel anecdotes to share, a bit of listener feedback, and then we're going to see how Google does the cha-cha with their new Adiantum ultra high performance cryptographic cipher mode.
Oh, sounds cool.
Lots of fun stuff to deal
with
today.
Awesome. Well, our show today is brought to you by Atlassian, and anybody who's a developer certainly knows what Atlassian's all about. I mean, Jira really became the way to do Agile. But honestly, Atlassian is so much more. We're an Atlassian house, and we use it like crazy. Of course, we use Jira to keep track of projects, who's doing what on where, and so forth. And, of course, it flows right into Confluence, which we also love. Confluence lets us document everything we're up to. Very important. And it has to be easy to document, because otherwise nobody wants to do documentation. So Confluence, by making it easy, by making it flow very simply from the work, really helps us do, I think, a better job. It's something we really appreciate. Atlassian is a collaboration software company that empowers teams all over the world. Staying competitive in this increasingly cloud-based world requires your IT team to plan and execute faster than ever. And because today's applications are more complex than ever, incidents often require open, agile, and smart, underline that word, coordination between operations and software development teams. Expectations are high, stakes are high. It's IT that's at the center, and falling short inside of business critical workflows, just that's not an option. Enter Atlassian. It's been such a boon for us. The company behind Jira, their software tools are designed to manage complex collaboration, not just for developers, though. And I think that's one thing Atlassian would like everybody to know. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all types, all sizes, from DevOps to Agile, from IT apps to Ops to ITSM, and whatever else is on your Kanban board, whatever else is next for you. Atlassian provides the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support the kind of change that makes business happen. Jira software, awesome. Confluence, there's Bitbucket if you have a code base. That's the backbone of effective cross-team project planning, organization, and communication. But then throw in OpsGenie, also an Atlassian product. StatusPage, they recently acquired Trello. They have a whole suite of tools to help you communicate, collaborate, solve problems, detect incidents, coordinate response efforts. Your team can choose the tool that's right for your current framework, but you can also trust that as you grow, those tools can grow with you. And it all integrates seamlessly with Jira and Confluence. We really appreciate that. So you don't have to bounce around from platform to platform. Like all of Atlassian's products, the tools for your team are easy and free to try. Just write it at Atlassian.com/IT. Atlassian.com/IT. Find the tools that are right for your team. Try them out. Implement them. I'm telling you, you'll be glad you did. Atlassian. Try it today to see what IT can be. Atlassian.com/IT. Steve?
So, no, I actually, come to think of it, I could have done a different picture. I should have done the picture of the algorithm for this new cipher, Adiantum.
Is it pretty?
I had this. Yeah, it is. And it is in the show notes later on.
We'll
so we will
it.
Get to
oh,
it.
Good. All right.
But anyway, I just like this. This was this beautiful piece of work, this ridiculously inexpensive PDP 1170 kit.
This is Oscar's kit.
Yeah, this is Oscar's kit.
Wow.
And look at the – I mean, he just does just a stunning job. I mean, that's just the
– that's the insides.
Yes, that's the PC board that no one will ever see, which is just, you know, gold-plated and a beautiful legend mask and, you know, spaces for all the lights and switches and things. And he's got light – you can see up at the top of the picture are light masks that – help to align the LEDs so that they line up properly. You don't have to like fudge them manually. And they also provide inter-LED isolation so the light from one doesn't bleed into the other.
He's Swiss, isn't he?
Yeah.
You can kind of tell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, just a beautiful piece of work. So I wanted to just sort of share that since someone had said that. And, you know, he did the injection molding to make those funky switch toggles. You know, the deck switch handles are this sort of this weird triangle with skirts. And they don't exist in the world. And so he made them so that they fit on top of these beautiful Alco switch toggles. And I mean, it's just a work of art.
What's the address? Or maybe we shouldn't send people there anymore, right?
We probably should. I think if you put in, guaranteed
obsolescence guaranteed.
There it is. Yeah. Obsolescence guaranteed. And then PDP 11 maybe, or just obsolescence guaranteed. But look at it. I mean, it's just, and so the whole thing is he did an injection molded bezel so that you have the silk screened front panel. I mean, and you end up, it's only like about 2 or 3 inches deep because it's based on the Raspberry Pi that is emulating the PDP 11. And so really all this is it's a physical IO device. It's switches and lights to emulate the PDP 11. And he sat down with a friend videotaping as they like toggled switches slowly on an actual PDP 11 to like get every light correct in. So it's like, it's just, again, yes, his perfectionism is something I completely relate to, and it's just a beautiful piece of work. And it's $250 for this amazing kit that is, you know, does not take a rocket scientist to build. So I just wanted to show it again. It's just a yeah. beautiful piece of work.
I did get on the list, and I got an email from him a little while ago saying fill out the form, and I've done that. I'm just waiting for.
Cool.
More.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a hobbyist who's nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
That's awesome.
You know, and he said, well, this turned into a little bit of a career, more than he expected. It's like, okay, yeah. As long as you want to do it. Yeah. So I didn't have a single one of my iOS devices prompt me to go get 12.1.4. Yet on every one of them, when I went looking, it's like, oh, we have a firmware update for you. So you may want to get it because aside from fixing the unattended FaceTime, did I say Facebook before? Probably. FaceTime eavesdropping bug that we talked about either a week or two ago, the one where somebody could add themselves to a group, you know, while calling you that would cause your phone to think that the person you're calling had answered. So that like you'd get like the zero notification activation of your microphone and camera. So Apple responded by quickly shutting down the group servers that took that feature away from FaceTime. Anyway, 12.1.4 is the fix that we expected to be immediately forthcoming. But in addition to that, there are 3 additional flaws which were fixed, 2 of which are being actively exploited in the wild as zero-day exploits. Google's Project Zero researchers found those 2 zero days, which they privately disclosed to Apple, and the third one Apple independently discovered and fixed. There's the 2 from Google. There's a memory corruption issue that could allow a malicious application to gain elevated privileges on the vulnerable device, and a different memory corruption issue that could allow a malicious application to execute arbitrary code with kernel privileges. So as always, we never get any further information. Apple's not saying anything. Google's not saying anything. It's just, okay, let's get this fixed. But that sort of demonstrates that, you know, as much focus as Apple puts on securing these things, we're still finding problems. And then the third problem, which is also fixed, was discovered by Apple themselves. It's a different flaw in FaceTime involving live photos, which they have now foreclosed. So probably worth updating. Again, as I said, none of my devices said, hey, we got an update. I don't know, like – some of them downloaded them. Some of them needed to download this update. Maybe they just like wait for you to go looking or to see the little red, the red badge on the settings icon and then go, oh, there's something I should do. I don't know. But
they roll it out bit by bit. Yeah. That's the problem. And so there are people like vulnerable who, like Lisa this morning said, oh, there's an update. Did you know? And I said, well, yeah, kind of, but.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and you're right, Leo, that's the problem is there are just so many of these devices out there that it's going to take a while. Oh, and let's not forget macOS. As a consequence of this increasingly shared code base, it is vulnerable to all of these problems. So macOS, you want to go to Mojave 10.14.3, which fixes all three of those iOS vulnerabilities, which macOS also had. So update all your Apple stuff. And a little bit later, I'm going to talk about this continuing problem that we have with security and why we just never seem to get this right. Google announced some things they fixed in their February 2019 updates for Android, and there were a trio of surprisingly worrisome Android PNG display bugs. Excuse me. Image display, which means this is in the PNG interpreter, which is invoked when anything on your Android device needs to render a PNG image, which says what? The web, any web page, any ad on a web page, a picture in an email that you receive and open, of a PNG received through instant messaging. So, I mean, it is a big vulnerability because it can execute arbitrary code. Google, in explaining what they have fixed, now that they have fixed it, said the most severe of these issues is a critical vulnerability in Framework that could allow a remote attacker using a specially crafted PNG file to execute arbitrary code within the context of a privileged process, meaning that this thing that's doing the interpretation is privileged. It's down in the kernel, not up where the user is. So this is a service being provided by the OS, which means if you have a problem there, the code that gets loose gets getting loose with the privileges of the process that was running it, which is the kernel. So they said the severity assessment is, which was, you know, highest, the severity assessment is based on the effect that exploiting the vulnerability would possibly have on an affected device, assuming the platform and service mitigations are turned off for development purposes or if successfully bypassed. They said, we have had no reports, this is important, no reports of active customer exploitation or abuse of these newly reported issues. They said, refer to the Android and Google Play Protect Mitigation section for details on the Android security platform protections and Google Play Protect, which improve the security of the Android platform. Under Framework, they said the most severe vulnerability in this section could enable a remote attacker using a specially crafted PNG file to execute arbitrary code within the context of a privileged process. The Hacker News site framed it a bit less clinically and probably more realistically. And to paraphrase what they wrote, they said, using an Android device, beware. You need to be more cautious when opening an image on your smartphone, downloaded from anywhere on the internet, or received through messaging or email apps. Yes, just viewing an innocuous-looking image, and of course they showed one of a kitten, could hack your Android smartphone thanks to three newly discovered critical vulnerabilities that affect millions of devices running recent versions of Google's mobile operating system ranging from Android 7.0 Nougat to its current Android 9.0 Pie. Although Google engineers have not revealed any technical details, the updates mention fixing a heap buffer overflow flaw and also errors in SKPNG codec and bugs in some components that render PNG images. So we know that Google, as we've talked about last year, Google is working diligently to improve the Android update ecosystem. That is, you know, working to require manufacturers to be responding to Android patches and to push them within some length of time. But what has already shipped has already shipped. And most of Google's efforts are necessarily forward-looking. You know, they can't retroactively amend the contracts that they've had the people sign about what they've already done. So that means that the bad guys now know that there are three vulnerabilities, one of which at least is very bad, allowing arbitrary code execution. And PNG rendering image flaws in Android since version 7, which was released on August 22nd of 2016. So 2.5 years ago, this flaw was introduced. Every version since and every phone sold since has it until it's updated with these February patches, which have just been released and announced by Google. And of course, they've made them available to partners, but we also know that doesn't mean a lot at the moment. So every phone sold in the interim for the last 2.5 years until and unless patched will be vulnerable to these flaws. Those who have been listening to this podcast since the summer of 2015, that is the year before that, will recall the Android stage fright exploit, which caused quite a bit of activity on both sides of the law, given that this problem only needs to display a PNG of a specially crafted image, and that these fixes are probably reverse engineerable by the bad guys, since Android has the mixed blessing of being way more open than Apple is with their iOS platform. I have a feeling we haven't seen the end of this. So it may well be that a month from now, we are talking about people receiving just an image on their phone and having their phone commandeered. So we'll see. What it means for our listeners is, if you are using Android, hopefully you have a phone from a manufacturer who will make those updates available, maybe directly from Google, maybe through a responsible manufacturer. Maybe you can go get them. Whatever it is, it would be good to get them, because I will be surprised if the bad guys don't jump on this. It is the problem is too many Android devices are either never going to get patched or are going to create a large window until they are patched. And, you know, the idea of just showing somebody a picture is, well, I mean, it's really bad. We recently covered the news of exposed remote desktop servers, the Microsoft's RDP remote desktop protocol is what typically Windows servers expose, which allows people with an RDP client to connect in order to get a remote desktop. And I guess apparently, based on behavior, either people believe it's safe to leave an exposed RDP server unmonitored to the internet for anyone who wants to. I mean, it's port 3389? You know, Shodan. Just do a search. You find all these port 3389s happily accepting connections. Hey, I'm RDP. Come guess my username and password. You can have a desktop. Oh, my Lord. Anyway, that's the world as it is now. So, and, you know, the new term is credential stuffing. which is what's the term that's now in vogue for brute force automated guessing of logon credentials. We used the term credential stuffing last week when we talked about the Japanese government, who is going to be scanning hundreds of thousands of their own citizens' IPs, performing credential stuffing attacks on anything they can find, typically IoT things, and see whether they can get in which case they're going to work with those people to tighten their security. So, I use RDP because I'm a Windows guy. I've got Windows servers. You won't find a port 3389 open anywhere because people would be loony to it's crazy to have a server like that exposed. But Checkpoint Research became curious, not about the security of RDP servers, which we already know is frightening, but about the security of the client connected to an RDP server. The RDP protocol is extremely complex and was developed in the dark as opposed to in the light of day, being, as it is, a proprietary protocol of Microsoft's. So, of course, this hasn't prevented its reverse engineering by others, and several third-party and open-source clones exist. You know, client clones exist of RDP clients. But as we know, a complex protocol, if you put that in quotes, should give any security-aware person pause, since we know that complexity is the enemy of security. No one should be surprised to learn that the RDP clients are rife with exploitable flaws. Checkpoint wrote in their disclosure, they said, as an overview, used by thousands of IT professionals and security researchers worldwide, the remote desktop protocol, RDP, is usually considered a safe and trustworthy application to connect to remote computers. Whether it is used to help those working remotely or to work in a safe VM environment, RDP clients are an invaluable tool. However, Checkpoint Research recently discovered multiple critical vulnerabilities in the commonly used remote desktop protocol that would allow a malicious actor to reverse the usual direction of communication and infect the IT professional or security researcher's computer. In other words, if the RDP server you connect to with your RDP client has been maliciously modified, it can attack your client, your machine from which you are connecting with a vulnerable RDP client, and it turns out they all are, in order to hurt you. They found 16 major vulnerabilities and a total of 25 security vulnerabilities overall. They looked at three clients, the de facto default Microsoft built-in RDP client is MSTSC, which is, you know, Microsoft Terminal Services Client is their name. But there are two others that are popular and mature open source clients. There's one called FreeRDP, which is the most popular RDP client on GitHub. And there's RDesktop, which is an older open source RDP client, which happens as an interesting twist to come by default in Kali Linux distros, which is interesting because Kali Linux is what many red teams use as their security platform. And should they use RDesktop to work to penetrate a remote machine, it could penetrate them instead. Okay, so Checkpoint wrote, as is usually the case, we decided to start looking for vulnerabilities in the open source clients. It seems it will only make sense to start reverse engineering Microsoft's client after we will have their English is a little broken, but I'm going to read what they wrote. After we will have a firm understanding of the protocol. In addition, if we find common vulnerabilities in the two open source clients, we could check if they also apply to Microsoft's client. In a recon check, it looked like R Desktop is smaller than FreeRDP, has fewer lines of code. And so we selected it as our first target. And I'm going to go into some detail here because I think our listeners will find the strategy that they adopted and the way they talk about what they found to be interesting, sort of as an inside look into how an organization like Checkpoint that is very mature security research, you know, how they tackle something like this. So they chose the first, they went for the open protocol, the open source, because that was examinable. And then they went for the smaller of the two just because there was less to examine. Then they said, we decide, the argument being, if they find problems there, then that would give them a starting point for looking at the closed source Microsoft implementation. So they said, we decided to perform an old-fashioned manual code audit instead of using any fuzzing technique. The main reason for this decision were the overhead of writing a dedicated fuzzer for the complex RDP protocol, together with the fact that using AFL that's the American Fuzzy Lop is one of the often used fuzzers, that using AFL for a protocol with several compression and encryption layers didn't look like a good idea. In other words, fuzzing, as we've talked about before, is the process of just throwing stuff at an API, just giving it a bunch of stuff and see if the system crashes.
It's like system events, though, always is like clicks and mouse moves and stuff like that, or is it?
Yeah.
It's mostly
system
events.
Yeah. So, when you're actually connecting to the server, there is in the case of RDP, a deep API.
Oh, so you have to send all sorts of garbage over the API.
Yes. Yeah. And the problem is, so much of it is going to be that. So the idea is the API is so highly structured that meaningful exploits are probably not going to be random. That there's so many ways that the API would reject fuzz that your likelihood of finding something is really low. That would require that they write a custom fuzzer that is protocol aware, in order not to just be rejected out of hand. And so they thought, okay, we're not going to write custom fuzzing code. Let's just take a look at the code. So they just started reading the source. They first started, as I mentioned, with R Desktop version 1.8.3. They said after a short period, it looked like the decision to manually search for vulnerabilities paid off. We found several vulnerable patterns, and I'll explain that in a second, in the code, making it easier to feel the code and pinpoint the location of possible vulnerabilities. And it's like when you read code, you can get a feel for the personality of the person who wrote it. I mean, if you looked at my assembler, you would absolutely get a sense for me. I mean, code is that expressive, where you can see like, oh, okay, Steve, he's weird. He'll push some arguments onto the stack because he's going to later need to use them when he calls something. And rather than popping them off the stack just to then push them on the stack as arguments to the call, he'll pre-push them a ways ahead to have them there and then not go through popping and then repushing, because he understands what's actually happening in the processor. And so you'll look at that and go, you know, but I'm careful to comment that because it's like, okay, someone looking at my code will go, wait, why is he pushing these over here? And so I always comment mostly as much for myself as for someone else. It's like, these are being pushed because these are arguments that'll be used down lower a ways. And so I might as well just have them there waiting for that function. Anyway, the point is code is really can reflect the, you know, like the personality, for lack of a better term, of the person writing it. And what they saw was they saw some habits that this coder had that were bad. They were bad coding habits. So, you know, not just obscure, which is what you might call mine, but actually dangerous. So what that did was that allowed them to then look for instances of the use of this bad habit and see if they were located in vulnerable places. And they found 11 vulnerabilities with a major security impact and 19 vulnerabilities overall in the library. Just after getting a sense for the habit of the coder, where they saw that, oh, he's doing some things that aren't really that safe, and that caused some problems. They also noted, as an aside, that the other end of this X or this R desktop connection was an XRDP server, which is also open sourced and based on that same R desktop code, which led them to believe that they did some additional recon, and based on their findings, it appears that similar vulnerabilities can be found in RDP as well. And that's a concern because that's a service. That is a server as opposed to a client, which might be exposed and now is believed to have some problems. So I'm not going to go into detail because I just kind of wanted to give our listeners a sense for the way they operated with this. In their disclosure, and I got a link in the show notes. In their disclosure, they've got screenshots and details for anyone who's really curious about like the nature of the programmer's personality that they found and what it meant. But to sum it up, they characterized what they found as leading up to, as they put it, massive heap-based buffer overflows. They wrote, by chaining together these two vulnerabilities, they were sort of related, each pair found in three different logical communication channels, they wrote, we now have three remote code execution vulnerabilities they found in the client. And then dealing with a different instance of a vulnerability, they wrote, and this would have been given a CVE of 2018-8795, remote code execution. They said another classic vulnerability is an integer overflow when processing the received bitmap for screen content updates. Remember that this is remote desktop, so the server is sending the client chunks of its screen, thing like regions of screen that have changed and need to be updated. So the server is saying, here's a rectangular bitmap region of the screen with this width, this height, and this pixel depth. So what they noted was, although the bitmap width and height parameters are only 16 bits each, by multiplying them together with the bits per pixel, the pixel depth, it's possible to trigger an integer overflow, meaning that 16-bit value times a 16-bit value times the bits per pixel depth can overflow 32 bits, which is the integer value that was being used here, and lead to badness. They said later on, the bitmap decompression will process our input and break on any decompression error, giving us a controllable heap-based buffer overflow. And they said this calculation can be found in several places throughout the code of our desktop. So we marked it as a potential vulnerability to check for in the free RDP, that is that, you know, the other open source RDP client. So then of free RDP, they wrote and they tested 2.0.0 RC3, so release candidate 3. They said after finding multiple vulnerabilities in our desktop, we approached free RDP with some trepidation. Perhaps only our desktop had vulnerabilities when implementing RDP. They said, we still can't be sure that every implementation of the protocol will be vulnerable. And indeed, at first glance, they wrote, the code seemed much better. There were minimum size checks. Oh, and that's what was missing from that code pattern that they kept seeing in the way our desktop was coded. They weren't checking for minimal sanity. They weren't doing a sanity check, as I call it in my code, for minimum size. So before parsing the data from the received packet, which was the primary feature missing from our desktop. And they said, and the code feels more mature. They wrote, it's going to be a challenge. However, after a deeper examination, we started to find cracks in the code. And eventually, we found critical vulnerabilities in this client as well. And I should note that here's another perfect example of the fact that just because the code is open and can be audited doesn't automatically mean it's more secure. Nobody ever apparently looked before. So, you know, there it is, and it's open, and it's free, and it's full of bugs. So, and we've talked about this, you know, like back and forth, is closed better than open and so forth. And it's like, yes, open source has the potential to be verifiably secure, but somebody has to go verify it. You know, just the fact that it's there doesn't mean that it's any better than something that somebody wrote and didn't publish open. So they said they found critical vulnerabilities in this client as well. They found 5 vulnerabilities with major security impact and 6 vulnerabilities overall in the library. Then some additional sleuthing discovered that the RDP client Neutrino RDP, which is a fork of an older version of free RDP and therefore probably also suffers from the same vulnerabilities. Well, it exists and probably bears scrutiny if anyone is using it. They said at the end of our research, we developed a proof of concept exploit for this client, which they were able to demonstrate. And then also there's something they called this same integer overflow. They said, as we saw earlier in our desktop, calculating the dimensions of a received bitmap update is susceptible to integer overflows. And indeed, free RDP shares the same vulnerability. So there was some, you know, even if the code didn't, if neither project inherited code from the other, both implementations failed to check for the you know, basically believed the server they were connecting to and were not being defensive about the data coming from the server. And basically these clients, as we often see, are interpreters. And so these interpreters, these RDP client interpreters, were just taking on faith the safety of what the RDP server was providing and were very vulnerable to that. So what about Microsoft, the original RDP client from which these were reverse engineered? Since as far as I know, Microsoft never formally published the protocol. And of course, Microsoft's original RDP client is the one that's built into all of our Windows machines. And it's the one which Windows users will be using. If you are on Mac or on Linux, then you're probably using one of these other clients if you're connecting with remote desktop to a Windows server. So these guys wrote, "We started by testing our proof of concepts, the ones they had developed, the proof of concept exploits they developed for the other two, for the vulnerabilities in the open source clients. Unfortunately," well, unless you're a Windows user, they said, "unfortunately for the success of those proof of concepts," but they wrote, "unfortunately, all of them caused the client to close itself cleanly without a crash." So the client just said, "Okay, I don't know what I've connected to, but this doesn't seem like a valid Windows server. I'm going to go away now." So just it shut down without crashing. Then they said, "Having no more excuses, we opened IDA," which of course we've discussed recently also. That's IDA, the Interactive Disassembler. And they said, "We started to track the flow of messages. Soon enough, we realized that Microsoft's implementation is much better than the implementations we tested previously." They said, "Actually, it seems like Microsoft's code is better by several orders of magnitude, as it contains several optimization layers for efficient network streaming of the received video, robust input checks, robust decompression checks to guarantee that no byte will be written past the destination buffer, and additional supported clipboard features." Needless to say, there were checks for integer overflows when processing bitmap updates. So Microsoft's client is written to protect the system using it to connect to a remote foreign server. They said, however, Checkpoint researchers did find some troubling flaws in clipboard sharing. They go into great detail in their posting, so I didn't want to drag us through that because there isn't much. I mean, there is a lot of technical detail, but nothing of much interest. But remote desktop protocol supports clipboard sharing. And it turns out that it's possible for a malicious RDP server with Microsoft's current RDP client to use classic path traversal attacks to place files anywhere on the user's system, limited only by the user's current privileges. So the RDP client is running in the context of the current user, so that's good. It's not running with any elevated privileges. But Microsoft's client is susceptible to a path traversal attack, so that if the server you're connecting to were modified or the protocol intercepted or somehow manipulated, files could be placed anywhere that you have permission to do so. And you have permission to put files in your startup folder, which would mean that they would be executed next time you log in or start the system. So that's not good. They also discovered that the RDP server, if it were not well behaved, that is, if it were malicious, could dynamically monitor the client's clipboard, because there's clipboard sharing, which is enabled by default, and that anything that the user transiently places on their clipboard, the remote desk, while you have RDP open, a connection open, the server gets a notification and the contents of the clipboard on the fly. So, for example, if you just pasted a complex admin password, that goes to the server, even if you don't do anything with it explicitly over the connection, even if it's only briefly present. So then they, in their posting, they outlined their disclosure timeline, because they did full responsible disclosure for this. And the short version is the free RDP and the R desktop supporters immediately responded, quickly fixed the problems, asked that that checkpoint verify the fixes and give them the green light. They did fix the problems. Checkpoint gave them the green light, and there are now new versions of both FreeRDP and R Desktop. Microsoft responded, "Thank you for your submission. We determined your finding is valid, but does not meet our bar for servicing." I put in here parenthetically. In other words, we have much bigger problems over here. Anyway, they said, "So yeah, we agree that could happen. We're not going to fix it."
You'd have to log into a malicious RDP server, though.
Correct.
That's probably what they're thinking is.
Correct.
Well, it's on you then, buddy.
Exactly. Well, and how likely is it, really? I mean, a Windows user is probably always going to be logging into a Windows RDP server, not something else.
Right.
So it seems very unlikely that would be the case. Out of an abundance of caution, they do note that the clipboard sharing can be disabled. It's a simple configuration checkbox over on your client, whether you want to share your clipboard with the server. And so if you have occasion or any reason to mistrust the server you are connecting to, you could disable clipboard sharing. That's the only problem that they found in the Microsoft RDP client. And for what it's worth, if you are a Linux or Mac user, it's worth updating. This is all just happened. Do get the later versions of R Desktop or FreeRDP if you use those. I mean, in any event, this is a reverse attack against you by a malicious server you connect to. Interesting from a technical standpoint. Interesting from a let's take a look at how defects are born, but not nearly as big a concern, for example, as all the Android devices for the last 2.5 years that can be compromised when displaying a PNG image from that they receive from anywhere. That's one to worry about. And Leo, my dry throat is one to worry about too.
I am so worried about your dry throat, so I shall take over. And
thank you.
You may medicate in any way you see fit. Our show, let me guess, a giant mug of coffee. our show today brought to you by IT Pro TV. It has been for years. We love IT Pro TV. They first came to us, some years ago. They said it was actually Tim Broom and Don Pezzett. They said, we are IT trainers, have been for years. We saw your presentation at NAB. We thought it'd be really interesting to kind of do what Twit is doing, but for IT training, so that you can get the certs you want for the job you want. And I said, that's great. Go for it. And they said, well, of course, we want to tell your audience about it. And Security Now audience number one, they have created over those past, 5 years now, an amazing, amazing product, IT Pro TV, binge-worthy, flexible, affordable IT training, whether you're already in IT and you just want to level up, or if you want to get into IT. Actually, that's a tough thing to do these days because you may have plenty of experience, doing this unofficially for your work or for your family and friends, but that's not work experience. And if you're going to get a job in IT, they usually want, in lieu of work experience, they want certificates, proof that you have the knowledge. So there's all these certs in all sorts of areas, and that's what IT Pro TV focuses on, giving you the training you need to get the certs you want. They have over 4,000 hours worth of binge-worthy on-demand training. They're making 100 hours more every week. That 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, they have 5 studios firing on all cylinders, engaging instructors, live chat rooms, kind of like us, who are real experts in the field. The courses include the new CompTIA A+ Core Series, Cisco's CCNP, ISC Squared CISSP, AWS Specialty Courses, and more. You're going to get the training you want, fun, engaging training, in the areas that are most valuable to you. there's Don, of course, and Adam Gordon and Daniel Lowry and just the rest of the IT Pro TV gang. They are fun. It's really like watching or listening to your favorite podcast. And they make it like that easy to watch because they have Roku, Amazon Fire Stick, Apple TV, PC, iOS, and Android apps. You can Chromecast it to your big screen TV, then listen to it in the car on the way to work, and then have it in the lower corner of your screen all through work, and just by almost osmosis learn all this stuff. IT Pro TV edutainers, the people who actually do the training themselves, have 288 certs amongst them. I didn't even know there were that many. And they're adding new content all the time. I love IT Pro TV. Whether you're getting it for your entire team, and this is very common. They get the team portal, and they will have training for the entire team to keep everybody's skills up to date. Or if it's just for you, and you just, you know, you're ready to get an IT, or you just want to learn this stuff, February is a great time to IT Pro TV and chill. By the way, I have the T-shirt, IT Pro TV and chill. It's very romantic. Grab the popcorn, learn from the best. Go to IT. Actually, the website, they've got a new address they want to use. go.itpro.tv/security now. go.itpro.tv/security now. Get started with IT Pro TV, and this is their biggest sale yet. Their standard membership, which is basically the video-only subscription, usually it's $57 a month, which I even think is a very fair price. It's on the site right now during just this limited time at $29 a month, which is even, that's really amazing. But we're going to make it even better because if you use the code SN30 at checkout, SN30 at checkout, you'll cut 30% off that, which means you're going to get started in IT or advance your career for around $20 a month. And that's forever, as long as you stay active. That's for the life of your account. go.itpro.tv/security now. go.itpro.tv/security now. The code is SN30, 30% off IT Pro TV. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, and life-changing results. And a bunch of great people, too, to learn from. Like this guy right here, Mr. Steve Giant Mug Gibson. Look at that.
Yeah.
Yow. Yowza.
So any users of LibreOffice and Apache's OpenOffice should update. Excuse me. There was a classic path traversal vulnerability in those. It's funny how that's like always bit us. The idea of ….//.. It's sort of a clever hack, but boy, has it caused problems historically. A security researcher, Alex Infuhr, has discovered a severe remote code execution vulnerability in both of these open source Office suites that can be triggered just by opening a maliciously crafted ODT. That's the open document text file format. The attack relies on exploiting, as I mentioned, a directory traversal flaw, which has a CVE 2018-16858. It automatically executes a specific Python library bundled within the software. Libre, both of these Office suites bundle their own Python interpreters, so you don't have to have one separately installed. It's there. And by mixing a white-colored link with an on mouseover event and turning the whole page into a link, he's able to get this thing to trigger. So all it requires is that a user open one of these maliciously crafted documents and bad guy's code runs on your system. He wrote in his disclosure that the Python file named pydoc.py that comes included with LibreOffice's own Python interpreter accepts arbitrary commands in one of its parameters and executes them through the system's command line or console, thus essentially creating a pipeline that allows the attacker-supplied command to execute even though it's in a document. That PyDoc.py sort of has a security problem with it. I mean, like fundamentally. He provided a proof of concept video demonstration, which shows how he's able to trick that event into call the on mouse over event into calling a specific function within the Python file, which then executed the payload that he'd provided through a Windows command line and showed no indication, no warning dialogue of any kind to the user. And he didn't really have great success. We've talked before about the problems that researchers have. Some researchers have even been grumbly about, like how difficult it has been to report problems. There was a little bit of that. He said, at first I reported it via the LibreOffice Bugzilla system. Apparently for security issues, it's better, he said, to send an email to officesecurity@lists.freedesktop.org. He said, but I didn't know that. In fact, you know, we've talked about the initiative for there to be some sort of consistent reporting path independent of organizations, some way for people who discover vulnerabilities to be able, to know who to talk to, especially if, you're not doing this all the time. It takes some digging around. He said, anyway, so my Bugzilla report got closed, but I convinced them to have another look. The bug was picked up and moved to a thread via office security at lists.freedesktop.org, which is where it should have gone. He said the issue was verified and fixed quite quickly. However, so that was on the LibreOffice side. OpenOffice confirmed via email that they have a problem, that they recognize there's a problem, but OpenOffice does not allow the passing of parameters. So his proof of concept doesn't work as it was developed for LibreOffice. But the path traversal is still there and can be abused to execute Python script from another location on a local file system. So at this point, I would opt for LibreOffice if I had a choice, because those guys jumped on it and actually fixed the problem. So, no real more big message there beside the fact that if you are using LibreOffice, you want to just check for an update, which is waiting, depending upon how long it's been. Also, I picked up an interesting little tidbit from a Blue Hat security conference, which was which occurred in Israel last week. Microsoft security engineer Matt Miller said that over the past 12 years, not changing very much, around 70% of all Microsoft patches were fixes for memory safety bugs. I guess it shouldn't really surprise us. Leo, you've got the graph that Mike provided in his slides from his presentation on the screen. Basically, showing kind of a, it looks like one of those tanks with oil and water in it, that where the oil, doesn't mix with the water, and it sort of like has a wave going back and forth. There's just sort of a wavy blue line separating the light blue from the dark blue, with a dotted red line right at 70%. And it's maybe a little more than average over 70, but it's, kind of around 70, dipped down below a little bit for a while in 2012. But basically, the point is, over a decade and 2 years, 12 years, we've not seen much change. It's always been around 70. And despite everyone's efforts at like improving things, address space layout randomization, and doing everything we can, I guess I would argue that it would have gotten a lot worse if we hadn't fought back with technology to work against these memory-related problems. But it's pretty much been a standoff at 70%, which is sort of interesting. So that would be, all memory-related things. Now, arguably, it's a big bucket, a catch-all. There's buffer overflow. There's memory-related race conditions, page faults, null pointers, stack exhaustions, and heap corruptions, use after free vulnerabilities or double free vulnerabilities where you free something and then free it again and that causes another upset. So, you know, so that is, you know, arguably a bunch of stuff. But again, it's been hovering at 70%. Anyway, the reason Matt explained for this high percentage is because Windows, he says, and I agree, has been written mostly in C and C++, which he describes as two memory-unsafe programming languages that allow developers fine-grained control over the memory addresses where their code can be executed and where data can be stored. Just a simple mistake in the developer's management of memory can lead to exploitable memory errors that attackers can exploit to obtain remote code execution or the elevation of their privilege within the system. And we know that's the case. Anyone who's looked at C realizes, I mean, you can put anything you want to into a pointer, and if you dereference that pointer, you're accessing your memory space. So, I mean, there's no abstraction. There's nothing between you and the bare metal, which is, I mean, that's why C was written. We've talked about this a number of times through the years, is, you know, Kernighan and Ritchie developed C to be like a, I mean, they wrote the first Unix in assembler. And then they said, okay, let's do a minimal abstraction on top of assembly language in order to like give us some convenience, you know. So C is a very small language. It adds just a small layer on top, and then it uses libraries in order to further expand the language. So again, programmers like it because they want the power that comes with it. Unfortunately, with that power comes responsibility. And we seem to be having a problem with that. So, you know, as a consequence, all of this makes memory management and safety errors today's biggest attack surface for hackers. These errors are what attackers are capitalizing upon, thus the reason that what Microsoft patches are memory-related problems. His presentation, Mike Miller's presentation, asserted that use-after-free and heap corruption vulnerabilities remain the preferred go-to bugs for attackers searching for exploitable vulnerable code behavior. There's no big surprise there. And I've been mentioning recently that it's somewhat surprising to see how deeply entrenched existing computing technology actually is, meaning how reluctant we appear to be to really change anything fundamental, despite the fact that fundamental change is what we clearly need. You know, my own current focus, as everybody knows, has been on usernames and passwords to log into computers. But we're largely using the same technology today that, I mean, we've added, you know, password managers in order to deal with the problems of the fact that websites are unable to keep our secrets. We're using the same technology today that mainframe terminals used in the early 1970s, which is now approaching 50 years ago. This hasn't changed, which is mind-boggling. But similarly, coding has also not appreciably changed throughout all that time. You know, yeah, there have been, and we hear about various, you know, dynamic programming languages from time to time. There have been academic experimental memory-safe languages. where like the so-called, you know, the allocation is done for you. You're protected from yourself. Your variables are garbage collected after you in order so you don't have to worry about it, the whole allocation problem. But for many different reasons, they never gain foothold as a like a mainstream core implementation language. And if the language itself were to be safe, the problem is that they're still running on old school hardware architectures and being compiled or more likely interpreted, because these fancy languages tend to be interpreted, they're being interpreted by buggy interpreters running on old school hardware. So it never really gets us anywhere. And then, of course, there's programmer hubris, which is never to be underestimated in scope or depth. No programmer ever thinks they're going to make a mistake. And when they inevitably do, it's considered a mistake. Oops. And it's treated as though it won't ever happen again. But of course, it will and it does over and over and over. If this is going to change at some point, we need to rethink the whole thing. And I don't know where that rethink comes from. Maybe, you know, from some ivory tower somewhere. But I also wonder, will it really ever change at this point? Since it's been so long, Leo, that we've had what we've had. There was even a fourth processor, a fourth chip that was, you know, like ran fourth. And, you know, that sort of just never went anywhere.
I think it's probably easier to mess things up with fourth than almost anything. But
yeah,
to be honest, you know, it's a stack-based language. You can put anything on the stack, pop it off the stack, and
it's,
you know.
Well, and as we've often said, it's a write-only language.
Yeah.
Because you know you are basically the compiler, and it is really difficult to read fourth after the fact. You know, but I wonder really if there's any motivation in this direction, any true motivation. People say they want security, but they really don't insist upon it. They complain when something is insecure, but users cannot see security.
Right.
They don't understand what it really is. You know, it's not a feature. It's not an obvious benefit. It's a complete intangible. And of course, you know, we've used the analogy before, how we smugly lock the front doors of our homes that have easily broken glass windows.
Right.
So it's like, oh, okay, you know, a home would be much more secure if it were a bunker with no windows. But nobody wants to make that trade-off, even though, yes, it would be much more secure. So the presumption is, well, it's secure enough. Right. Until someone breaks in. You know, and it's well understood that Apple's iOS-based devices are significantly more secure than Android.
Yes.
They're not perfect.
Swift does a lot of memory management and garbage collection protection.
Yes. On the other hand, most Android devices are much less expensive. So that's what most people buy. I know people with Android, and it's like, it's good enough, and it was cheaper. So, you know, even though Apple has problems too, people buy Android. So I guess not only don't and won't people actually pay more for security, but this industry still doesn't actually have true security to sell them.
Yeah.
So maybe we are going to need more than three digits for this podcast, Leo.
There's got to be a way. Yeah, good. I hope so. There's got to be a way, though. I mean, NASA designs software that, you know, can't be patched.
But at such cost.
Yeah.
At such cost.
Maybe that's the answer.
And that's the problem.
Expensive. Yeah.
Using today's technology, today's computing technology, we can produce provably secure software. But no one has time.
Right.
No one, you know, it's just too expensive. So, you know, we don't bother.
Yep.
And speaking of updates, Mary Jo on This Week in Windows last week shared with you and Paul some news from Microsoft. We know that Windows 7 is now on extended life support. Security. Yes. Yes. Life support. Until this time, until February of 2020. So 1 year from now, we've talked about the idea that because, you know, it only just happened, despite all the crazy pressure Microsoft has put on the world to go to Windows 10. It only just happened that Windows 10 passed Windows 7 in usage. And nobody who has 7, mostly enterprises, wants to leave. You know, they're like, everything's working. And besides, Windows 10 has a bad rep or both. When it comes to privacy and this, you know, I mean, Leo, have you installed Windows 10 on a new machine?
It looks
like an arcade game. I mean, stuff is flipping up and down and jumping around, and you're being asked if you want, you know, candy corn dropped on you, or I don't even know what this is. It's just insane. I just look at this and I think, you got to be kidding me. Anyway, so it's no surprise that enterprise people want nothing to do with this nightmare. So anyway, Mary Jo shared last week, and I have a picture of what she posted over on ZDNet in the show notes. Windows Enterprise versions starting next year will be able to pay $25 per seat for continued updates for the year. Well, actually, wait a minute. January 20 through January 21. I don't understand that. Windows Enterprise.
Yeah, because this doesn't take effect till January 20th of 2020, till next year. The extended updates.
Oh, 2020. Right. 2020. Okay. So next year, $25. The year after, $50 per seat.
Doubles every year.
Yes. And the year after, $100 per seat.
Yeah.
That's the Enterprise, which is the cheaper of the two. If you are on Windows 7 Pro, it's $50 the first year, $100 the second year, and $200 the third year. So the idea is, yes, and this is not for end users. End users are going to get left in the cold. You know, I'm, you know, me. Actually, I have Windows 10 all over the place now, and I have arranged to strip the crap out of it. There's a bunch of things you can do in PowerShell that just removes all of this whatever the heck that crap is that they have in there now, the new apps that nobody wants. You know, I heard Paul a couple of weeks ago just saying to you, it's all junk. Have you looked at those Windows Store apps? They're just junk. It's like, yeah, but I guess they're secure junk. So, okay. Anyway, I'm making peace with Windows 10.
This is making peace? I can't wait to hear when you make war. Okay, yeah.
Anyway, the point is, for what it's worth to our people who are in enterprises, Microsoft is going to start pushing hard to, if you want to keep security updates and if you want to stay on Windows 7, they're going to start pushing hard starting next year to move people off. I don't know what enterprises will do. Maybe they'll just say, fine, we'll pay. Maybe they'll move, they'll give up and move to 10. Or maybe, you know, there is a version of 10. I think I heard Mary Jo talking about it, or I read about it. No, she did refer to it. There's a version of 10 that is available to enterprises that doesn't have any of this nonsense in it. End users can't get it. We can't get it. But there is one that Microsoft makes available that is like tamed. And so maybe that'll get made more widely available. I mean, nobody wants Xbox junk that you can't uninstall in your Windows 10 if you want nothing to do with Xbox. It's just Looney Tunes. And then ads for games. And anyway. So now we know what it's going to cost. We can't get it. Enterprises can, and it's going to cost a bit. Okay. maybe I've had too much caffeine. China's cybersecurity law actually went into effect last November, and we didn't talk about it much, but in light of Japan's forthcoming test, their own essentially pen test of their own network's IoT devices coming up here soon, I just wanted to note that, and I will be talking about Russia here next in a second, but China has, not surprisingly, given themselves some expansive powers. So I wanted to follow up on our discussion of Japan. This newly enacted law allows China's Ministry of Public Security, the MPS, which is the same agency which maintains China's Great Firewall and its national, and it runs its national facial recognition system and the surveillance camera network, has been since November empowered to conduct in-person or remote inspections of the network security defenses taken by companies operating in China, check for prohibited content banned inside China's border, log security response plans during on-site inspections, copy any user information found on inspected systems during on-site or remote inspections, perform penetration tests to check for vulnerabilities, perform remote inspections without informing companies, share any collected data with other state agencies, and has the right to have two members of the People's Armed Police, the PAP, present during on-site inspection to enforce procedures. So again, as we know, it's not a democracy. But I'm feeling like, as a consequence of this, as a consequence of what Japan is going to do, they are going to end up with much more secure network infrastructures, that is, public infrastructures, than we, the U.S., who so far refuse to allow white hat or government agencies to do the same. And I don't think this is going to stand. I bet you that we're going to see Australia follow suit, given the penchant that Australia has seen, and then probably the UK, and then I wouldn't be surprised if the US does. I just think, nice as it is to say, okay, you know, nobody gets to do this, to only allow the bad guys to do it. Look at the preponderance of evidence this last year of podcasts that we've been talking about. It was nice once, but it's just no longer practical. And I said we were going to talk about Russia. this is going to be really interesting to see. Russian authorities and major Russian internet providers are planning to disconnect the country from the internet as part of a planned experiment. The ultimate goal is for Russian authorities to implement a web traffic filtering system like China's Great Firewall, and to also arrange to have a fully working, self-contained, countrywide intranet, essentially that's what you would call it if it's no longer global, in case the country needs or chooses to disconnect. And you could imagine hearing in a Russian accent, why do we need the rest of world? So the initial experiment, which is intended to occur before, but hopefully not on April 1st, will serve to provide insight and feedback and possible modifications to this law, which is proposed to allow this to happen, which has been introduced in the Russian parliament last December. the first draft of the law mandated that Russian internet providers should be able to ensure the independence of the Russian internet space, which they refer to as RUNet, in case of foreign aggression, to disconnect the country from the rest of the internet. Additionally, Russian networking firms would have to install, quote, technical means, unquote, to reroute all Russian internet traffic to exchange points approved or managed by, Leo, our favorite organization, Roskomnadzor.
The FCC.
Yes.
Should we do this in the U.S.? What do you think? I don't think this is such a bad idea.
It's not such a bad idea.
Obviously in the U.S. you'd only do it in case of war. I mean, you wouldn't do it just because you didn't like what you were hearing from the outside world.
Right. Well, yes. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if we don't already have, you know,
a kill switch,
cut off switches on all cables coming, all transatlantic cables coming into the U.S. and satellite stuff.
Well, that's really interesting.
We probably do. The problem is it would cause chaos.
Yeah.
Our system would collapse if it didn't have access to because there's just the assumption of all these resources located globally.
Right.
What, to their credit, what Russia is doing is they're being upfront about it. They're saying, you know, we're going to start running experiments, you know, a series of
drills. Let's just see what would happen.
Yeah, exactly.
What would happen?
Let's just pull the switch.
Okay. We'll see.
Let's pull the plug and, So anyway, Roskomnadzor will inspect the traffic to block prohibited content. And that's really interesting, too, because, okay, they're saying they're wanting to experiment with routing everything through Roskomnadzor, but everything is TLS now.
Yeah.
So that suggests
you can only turn it off or on. You can't really.
Yeah, you can't look in it unless you get the Russian root cert that they're going to force everybody in Russia to have.
Well, they might do that.
I think China is going to do it. And anybody, any state that insists on being able to inspect the traffic, the contemporary traffic of their citizenry, has to put a root cert on every machine and then perform, you know, fake cert creation and proxying at the border. That's the only way to do it, is to perform a state-sanctioned man-in-the-middle inspection of traffic.
Wow.
Anyway, the Russian government has been working on this project for years, and in 2017, Russian officials said they plan to route 95% of all internet traffic locally by 2020. That is meaning through Roskomnadzor.
To pull I like this how off, you say that.
Buckle your seatbelts. To pull this off, they'll still need their own DNS. So authorities have built in-country backup of the entire domain name system. It was first tested in 2014 and then again last year. It will be a major component of Ruskinet. Wait, no, RUNet.
Oh, I like Ruskinet. That's good.
Ruskinet. Ruskinet. When ISPs plan to pull the plug and disconnect the country from the rest of the world. So we're going to, before long, next month or before the 1st of April. So we're going to be talking about what happened when Russia pulled the plug on the internet.
Wow. Woo-hoo. Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you use 1.1.1.1 in the U.S. and we cut off our internet connection, your DNS would go down.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're so interconnected at this point. You can't.
Yeah. Yeah. But I really, you know.
On the other hand, you need a kill switch because. You know,
I'm sure there's no chance right now, given what we know about the internet, that there isn't one that can isolate the country. And the problem is
It would isolate the country.
Everything will break.
That's the problem.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everything will break.
Very interesting.
So I just wanted to mention also that we talked about Firefox's suspension of Release 65, which was warning its users who had Avast and AVG, AV, and also some others. All the vendors have now issued updates, the AV vendors, to suspend their scanning of traffic if for users of Firefox. So Mozilla has resumed rolling out 65. So for what it's worth, if Firefox users want AV scanning, you'll need to switch to a different browser, probably use Chrome, or just rely, as you and I do, Leo, on Defender. That does very good. It's rated now. It's ranked up right up there with their other guys. Very good antivirus, and it does so because it's native to the OS. It doesn't need it doesn't cause Firefox a problem. So, yay. Speaking of yay, let's take our final break, and then I'm going to share a couple squirrel anecdotes and some feedback with our listeners, and then we're going to talk about Google's very nice piece of work.
That's kind of appropriate, actually. We're taking a break here because our sponsor for this section is Sophos.
Ah, nice.
And you know we love Sophos. Sophos is an enterprise protection that we use, lots of people use. And, of course, if you're in the business of protecting enterprises from bad guys, one of the things that's going to be most valuable to you, because this is such a fast cat and mouse game. You think of something, they think of something against it. You it's back and forth, back and forth. If you could use AI, if you could use deep learning to kind of learn how bad guys work, you can interpret data, respond to threats, adjust to threats at lightning speed. And that's exactly what Sophos is doing. In fact, they were recently ranked number one by an independent security test done by SE Labs, best protection rating across the board for both large enterprises and small businesses. They have the same technology in a version for the home. The Sophos Home delivers real-time protection on your Mac or PC or on your family and friends' Macs and PCs, and that's what I'm really interested by. It provides protection from ransomware, and by the way, the latest ransomware. Immediately, it's up to date. Malicious software, hacking, people trying to break in, and more. It's incredibly easy to use, and the beauty part is you can use it to secure a single device or to manage the security of multiple devices in your home or even around the world because it's from Sophos. So this is enterprise-grade protection. That's something an enterprise tool would need. You now have that in your home. You sign up for one account. You protect all the Macs and PCs in your home. You have a single console. And because it's cloud-based, you can use it to keep your relatives secure even if they're thousands of miles away. I'm getting it from my mom for sure. You can remotely manage their security, clean up threats, keep their systems safe. Sophos tagline is security made simple, and they absolutely live up to this with Sophos Home. It's very easy to use. You literally log in from your browser and you start securing systems today. Whether you're a home user or a large enterprise, Sophos has you covered. That's the message. Some of the largest businesses in the world use Sophos. Some of the smallest, like ours, use Sophos to protect us from ransomware attacks that devastated business last year. Big problem with Petya and not Petya, but Sophos had your back. Third-party reviewers consistently rank Sophos among the best cybersecurity providers. And because of this synchronized security, which I really like the idea of, you can manage all your Sophos products from one cloud-based console wherever you are. So that's the pitch. Go get a free trial right now. Or you can still do a free security scan. They will continue to offer that at Sophos, Sophos.com. It's another way, a better way to protect your systems. Sofo and your family. And it's at Sophos.com. We thank them so much for their support of security now. Stephen?
Ha! Okay. So I'm going to share three anecdotes and then talk a little bit about why why I'm not doing more. Dom SCH is his handle in the Squirrel Forums. And he said, just wanted to chime in. I created my first squirrel ID months back without having a use for it. Of course, I lost the restore codes. So after listening to SN700, meaning last week's episode, on my commute yesterday and today, I set up a new identity. Created on my Android phone with the awesome Android app. Signed on to the forums in seconds. And 5 minutes later, signed on to the forums on my work PC without any problems. He wrote, "This is awesome. The biggest thing for me, it's independent of a password manager," which is not to say we don't love password managers. I'm, you know, glued to mine, but we all need them right now. His point is, and he writes, "The password manager extension is one of the big things keeping me with Firefox. I'd really like to switch to Falcon, but without my passwords, that's a no-go." He says, "So here is me hoping Squirrel will find wide adoption on all platforms so I can finally leave my password manager behind." He wrote, "Thanks, Steve, for creating this awesome authentication method and especially for not going with the early bird alpha pre-order green light approach that's so common nowadays, but instead doing it right and delivering an actually 100% working product." Then Korma P said, and I just picked these comments up in the forums. He says, "I installed the Android Squirrel client a week or two ago and have just used it to register here for the first time. I foolishly forgot my password for my identity." And I think, okay. He says, "So I reset the password using the rescue code. Painless. Logged into the forums using Squirrel. Painless. Set up two-factor using the LastPass authenticator. Painless." He says, he said, "All good so far. My question is, can I avoid having to re-enter my password when logging into a site on my phone? Or can I just use the phone's fingerprint sensor? Or is it simply because I've only logged in twice? Am I missing the paint doing something wrong? Thanks." He said Cosma. So maybe it is Cosma. Or maybe I just – no, I maybe – anyway, he spelled it differently. And to answer his question, first of all, he used the features that I built into the whole system to allow people to do their own password recovery, because exactly what he had happened is going to happen. And with Squirrel, because it is rigorously – two-party, there's no one to go crying to if you forget the one password you only ever need. The good news is you only need one ever for all your sites that use Squirrel, so you're much less likely to forget it. But it could happen. Or you could re-enter it twice, you know, and then forget. You could change it and forget what you changed it to. So anyway, this solves all those problems, and it worked for him. I'm asking Jeff Arthur, who's the author of the iOS version, to be less rigorous with unlocking Squirrel on the iPhone, under the assumption that if you've unlocked your phone with your fingerprint or your face, then you've already just – in fact, you have to do it per authentication. So you are right then – re-authenticating yourself to the Squirrel app. Right now, he's been following the protocol I use on my Windows client, where it's a little finickier about making you re-enter your whole password, because in its default mode, Windows doesn't have biometrics built in, whereas the iOS, the newer iOS phones, as we know, do, and even tablets, and Android. The most recent Android Pi has a usefully secure fingerprint authentication also. So to answer his question, yes, when this settles down, you will be able to only use a contemporaneous re-authentication in order to log on. And lastly, Ken RS said, and he was writing to Jeff in the forums, because all of the authors of the clients have their own development spaces there. He said, "Jeff, just trying your client on this forum, and it's great to see it working. The identity import using the printed QR code worked perfectly. Once set up, I scanned the QR code, the squirrel QR code appearing on my laptop screen with my iPad, and was instantly logged in on the laptop. And he says, that part does seem like magic. He says, logging in on device on the iPad also worked. The only thing that is still is rough is signing in using the fingerprint authentication on the iPad. Instead of logging in instantly, I'm left with Safari searching for localhost. Canceling that leaves me logged in. Regards, Ken. And yes, that's something that we are that Jeff will be fixing. So anyway, we're getting close. I'm sharing these anecdotes while a great deal of work is underway behind the scenes as we sort of are in countdown. It's become clear to the authors of the other Squirrel clients that this bread is just about baked and that Squirrel really does work and is actually going to happen. At least, you know, I mean, like, we'll have multiple clients and multiple servers and a working website where people can go and experiment with this. So right now, work is proceeding at an increased pace as we approach the finish line. I'm working to flesh out the Squirrel Forums content so there's material there for newcomers. At the same time, I need to update Squirrel's documentation, the online documentation, so that those who want to evaluate its underlying technology and operation will be able to do so, because those docs are 5 years old now and they are only barely reflective of the way things actually turned out. So I guess my point is that right now we're sort of getting a trickle of people who are – and those who really know it already, who have been in the news group, have moved over and are experimenting. It's sort of just the right level of activity that we can see problems and work to fix them. While you've been doing the sponsor breaks, Leo, I've been researching why I'm getting an very occasional server error 503 from the fast CGI module of IIS because it's running PHP. And now I think I know why, thanks to you talking to our listeners about Sophos. So
he uses anyway, those breaks intelligently, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, that's right. When you see me doing this, when you come back on to the camera, there's a reason
for it.
I love it.
You waste no time. I love it.
So anyway, I'm getting very excited and also very nervous. You can imagine, this has been a huge effort, but it really all is working, and it is very exciting. Oh, there's also a web extension running both under Firefox and Chrome, so you don't even need to have and that'll give us, you know, Mac and Linux, and there are people running my Windows app under Wine on a Mac. And so anyway, lots happening. I know I'm teasing people, but it's getting close, and We're right now, I have enough happening that if there was a flood of people, it would kind of overwhelm us. So we're just working out the details, because you know me, I'm a measure twice, or maybe 10 times, and cut once accurately person. So we're getting there.
Good. How exciting.
I'm very excited. So three things about PF Sense real quick. Dave, who tweeted from darkmatter_0x00. He said, hi, Steve. Great podcast. Quick question. A few episodes ago – oh, and we just heard a Yabba Dabba Doo. So thank you. Someone just purchased a copy of SpinRite, which I didn't talk about in this podcast. But, you know, it absolutely is the reason Squirrel exists, because our listeners and the public and those needing – to keep their hard drives in shape and to recover from problems have supported this effort as a consequence of purchasing something which is hopefully useful to them immediately, and which I have promised will be useful moving forward in the future, and which I will get back to as soon as this Squirrel project is behind me. He said, quick question. A few episodes ago, you mentioned a small firewall VPN device/router that can be bought. What was the name of it? Only has a few ports and ran PF Sense. Maybe I'm wrong about the PF part. Thanks. And of course, that was the SG-1100. And, you know, think of Steve Gibson, although there's no affiliation, dash, you know, as in SG, SG hyphen, what is the stamp for? Probably Secure Gateway. Anyway, SG hyphen 1100. If you Google that, it ought to take you to NetSense, I think it is, or NetGate. They're the people. So that's what it is. And yes, it is three ports, so a WAN port and two on the LAN side, which allows you to do network isolation. It does run pfSense, which is absolutely the drop-dead manager that you want. It is a beautiful – pfSense has a – just a really – well, first of all, it runs everything and has a web browser-based interface that allows you to do stuff. For example, I'm pulling off all kinds of networking magic thanks to having the flexibility that it offers. BLDG, which looks like Building 35, tweets at BLDG35. He said, "Hi, just wanted to say thanks for planting the idea in my head regarding pfSense. I've got my SG1100 online now, reconfigured my ASUS RT AC5300 to AP, you know, access point / AI mesh mode." And actually, that's exactly what I did with mine. He said, "I was surprised that I didn't lose any Wi-Fi features such as guest node isolation, etc." He said, "It didn't take too long to get an OpenVPN server running in pfSense for remote access. Also, for some reason, internet access feels noticeably faster. For instance, my 10 Ring security cameras, wow, now come up on my phone much faster in live view and recorded videos. Not sure why is that, but I'll take it." And, you know, for one thing, it is five times faster, the SG1100, five times faster than the predecessor SG1000. So, you know, it's one thing to have gig ports. It's another thing for them to be saturatable. And this little SG1100 is you know, great for $150. It's able to do that. And finally, Andy Black, BLAK, who tweeted under the same name, "Hi, hey, Steve. Recently you mentioned the NetGate pfSense products on Security Now. I purchased one after the show for my home network, though I'm having trouble configuring it. Do you have any recommendations for who could assist with this? NetGate charges $900 plus minimum for their support." He says, "I called them." He says, "Just looking for a more reasonable option. Many thanks, Andy." And the answer is yes. The Google is your friend. There is, the upside of pfSense is that, I mean, it can do anything. The downside is that it can do anything. It's way more comprehensive and therefore configurable and complete than any router. But with that comes, some configuration overhead. The good news is pfSense is the software you need to focus on, and there is a ton of how-to stuff on the internet. So just Google any question you have: pfSense, OpenVPN, how to set up OpenVPN, pfSense, how to brew my espresso stronger. Any question you could possibly ask, pfSense probably does it, and you'll find somebody who can help you. So don't be shy. And yikes, that is expensive support. So, just buy. In fact, I got a different email I didn't mention. Someone I said that they couldn't get the firmware from NetGate. They wanted a support contract. And it's like, well, that's ridiculous. You know, the pfSense firmware is freely available for the SG1100 on the internet. Once again, Google is your friend. Okay. What is Adiantum? I guess the question is, how can crucially important full disk encryption be offered on inexpensive commodity hardware which lacks any encryption acceleration? That's the question Google set themselves, because they have Android. They want to offer full disk encryption, but we know what that does if you run it on a platform without some assistance for AES. And, you know, think about this for a moment. Many of us now take for granted the fact that our devices at rest are fully encrypted, meaning that the mass storage of our device that our devices carry internally cannot simply be read out as a file system, either by good guys or bad guys who want to know what's in there. I mean, if, you know, again, I feel like we now just take that for granted on our mobile devices. But anybody running Android who doesn't have full disk encryption enabled has their file system storage as an unencrypted file system. And so anybody who gets a hold of it can just get it. I mean, it's just all there. So it's crucial that it be encrypted and decrypted on the fly. But as we've mentioned before, the reality for users of low-end Android smartphones who initially wanting full security activate their drive's whole disk encryption only to suffer such a reduction in performance that they're effectively forced to back out and just use their systems without that kind of encryption. The trouble is caused by our chosen, the industry's chosen, best-of-class cipher, Rheindahl, which was chosen, as we know, to be the AES, the Advanced Encryption Standard, which, while it's wonderfully secure, comes at the significant cost of per-byte encryption performance. And that overhead, that performance hit, is bad enough that back in 2010, when Intel introduced their new core, their Intel Core processor family with Westmere, that new silicon, and all silicon since, has incorporated six new instructions known as the AES-NI, which is for AES new instructions, because I guess all the cooler names were already taken. They specifically speed up the use of the AES cipher on Intel architectures. And it's not that AES cannot be done without those instructions. It can, of course. But each of those instructions is specific to an aspect of what the AES cipher algorithm needs, so that each is able to replace a great many more standard instructions to get the same job done much more quickly. The point being, yes, AES is super secure, but not very quickly without some help. And also, as we've discussed before, the reason encrypting the entire drive is so sensitive to the performance of its encipherment is that bulk enciphering must happen continuously on the fly for every byte of data read and written to the drive. That cipher is stuck in line and cannot be bypassed. So, happily, the bright lads at Google decided to take aim at this problem to see how they might improve upon the situation, since it's not simply to speed up the Rheindahl, it's not possible to simply speed up the Rheindahl cipher without hardware. They knew that they would need to replace Rheindahl with something else. This is feasible in any closed system where the cipher is only used for internal purposes. For example, when transacting over TLS, before the Cha-Cha 20 cipher got added to TLS, which has happened recently, there was no choice other to use AES, since its use there is for an external standard where you want to connect to a server remotely over a cipher that you both have. Maybe the other server doesn't have anything other than AES, so you've got to use it. But internally, deep inside an Android device, Google is 100% free to choose anything that works. And what works is this cipher I mentioned, ChaCha. There's a chart, big chart, in the show notes showing the performance of the bulk encryption mode known as XTS, which is what typically AES-256 cipher uses. It's the mode used for bulk encrypting mass storage versus Adiantum, which uses the ChaCha cipher, although in its reduced 12-round strength rather than its normal 20-round strength, because 12 is strong enough and they're going for speed here. The more rounds you have, the slower it is. Anyway, this bar chart shows about a 5-factor performance improvement, which is in fact what Adiantum delivers with ChaCha versus AES-256 for equivalent security margin, or with equivalent security margin. And I smiled when I saw ChaCha because it is the brainchild of the same person who designed the 25519 elliptic curve cipher that is entirely responsible for enabling Squirrel's solutions. That person is Daniel J. Bernstein, Dan Bernstein. So Google's online security blog last Thursday, February 7th, was entitled Introducing Adiantum, Encryption for the Next Billion Users. I guess they have high hopes for the the use of Android. But really, I mean, they've nailed it. And since I can't say any better than they have, I'm going to quickly share what they wrote. They said, today, Android offers storage encryption using the advanced encryption standard. Most new Android devices have hardware support for AES via the ARM V8 cryptography extensions. However, Android runs on a wide range of devices. This includes not only the latest flagship and mid-range phones, but also entry-level Android Go phones sold primarily in developing countries, along with smartwatches and TVs. In order to offer low-cost options, device manufacturers sometimes use low-end processors, such as the ARM Cortex-A7, which does not have hardware support for AES. On these devices, AES is so slow that it would result in a poor user experience. Apps would take much longer to launch, and the device would generally feel much slower. So while and remember that speed and power consumption also go hand in hand. You'd really like to run the chip slower and cooler, and thus use less battery if you could. So, while storage encryption, they write, has been required for most devices since Android 6.0 in 2015, devices with poor AES performance, and they say 50 megabits per second and below, and maybe that's megabytes. There's that M lowercase I B again. That's got to be megabytes. 50 million bytes and below are exempt. So that is to say, to make sure everyone heard that, even with Android 6.0, which requires hardware encryption, the AES hit is so onerous that if devices have lower performance, they are exempt from Google's own requirement. They said, we've been working to change this, because we believe that encryption is for everyone. In HTTPS encryption, they say this is a solved problem. the Cha-Cha-20 stream cipher is much faster than AES when hardware acceleration is unavailable, while also being extremely secure. It is fast because it exclusively relies on operations that all CPUs natively support: additions, rotations, and XORs. For this reason, in 2014, Google selected Cha-Cha-20 along with the Poly 1305 authenticator, which is also fast in software, for a new TLS cipher suite to secure HTTPS internet connections. Cha-Cha-20-Poly 1305 has been standardized as RFC 7539, and it greatly improves HTTPS performance on devices that lack AES instructions. So just to pause for a second, that means that light bulbs and low-end IoT devices that are performance challenged, as long as the server that they're connecting to offers this Cha-Cha-20 Poly 1305 mode of encipherment, which is now part of the TLS cipher suite spec, we'll be able to negotiate that with the server and end up with a much higher performance yet still equally secure protocol for moving bulk data across an encrypted connection. So that's all for the good, they said. Google said, however, disk and file encryption present a special challenge. Oh, note that we're talking about a stream cipher in Cha-Cha-20. Cha-Cha-20 generates a, given a key, generates a stream of pseudo-random bits, which then is XORed with the plain text to create the ciphertext, as opposed to AES, which is a block cipher, which produces blocks of 8 bytes, that's thus 128 bits at a time. Wait, blocks of 16 bytes, thus 128-bit blocks, which are then used in various modes to encrypt the plain text into ciphertext, typically CBC or some other block chaining mode to create an inter-block dependency. We've talked about all this in podcast past. But Cha-Cha-20 is a stream cipher. Anyway, so I wanted to make sure people understood the distinction. They said, however, disk and file encryption present a special challenge. Data on storage devices is organized into sectors, which today are typically 4096 bytes. When the file system makes a request, and actually they're noting, they're kind of mixing sectors and clusters. You know, clusters are typically clusters of sectors. Sectors still tend to be logically 512 bytes, but we now have clusters of 8 bytes. So, yes, clusters of 8 sectors, which end up with allocation units of 4096 bytes. So Google says when the file system makes a request to the device to read or write a, they said cluster, but they really meant a, I mean, yeah, they said sector, but they really meant a cluster. The encryption layer intercepts that request and converts between plain text and ciphertext. This means that we must convert between a 4096 byte plain text and a 4096 byte ciphertext. But to use RFC 7539, that's the streaming cipher used for TLS, the ciphertext must be slightly larger than the plain text. A little space is needed for the cryptographic nonce and for the message integrity information. In other words, you know, and we've talked about this all before, for these, in these normal block chaining modes, you have an initialization vector, a nonce that is at the front end, doesn't need to be secret, but does need to be unique. And then you also have an authentication tag added to the end, which is how you verify that nothing has changed in the stream. Both of those things slightly increase the length of what you're transmitting. But of course, since it's a communication stream, that doesn't matter. It's a tiny little bit added in front and at the end, no one cares. But you can't think about it. If it's a hard drive, you know, it's they're like fixed chunks of space. You can't, there's nowhere to stick extra stuff. You know, they're blocks. And so you need to take, and this is the point Google is making, you need to take a 4096 block and go, and that's the technical term, and turn it into a 4096 ciphertext and vice versa. You can't ask for a little bit extra space in the beginning and the end. There's none because they got the block ahead and the block behind. So Google says there are software techniques for finding places to store this extra information. That would be a mess. They're talking about like adding metadata to the file system. But they reduce efficiency and can impose significant complexity on a file system design. Where AES is used, the conventional solution for disk encryption is to use the XTS or CBC ESSIV modes of operation, which are length preserving. Currently, Android supports AES 128 CBC ESSIV for full disk encryption and AES 256 XTS for file-based encryption. However, when AES performance is insufficient, there is no widely accepted alternative that has sufficient performance on lower-end ARM processors. To solve this problem, we have designed a new encryption mode called Adiantum, A-D-I-A-N-T-U-M, Adiantum. Adiantum allows us to use the Cha-Cha stream cipher, which is very fast on commodity hardware without acceleration, in a length-preserving mode. By adapting ideas from AES-based proposals for length-preserving encryption, such as HCTR and HCH, on ARM Cortex-A7, Adiantum encryption and decryption on 4096 byte sectors is about 10.6 cycles per byte, making it around 5x faster than AES 256 XTS. They said, unlike modes such as XTS or CBC ESSIV, Adiantum is a true wide block mode, changing any bit anywhere in the plain text will unrecognizably change all of the ciphertext and vice versa. It works by first hashing almost the entire plain text using a keyed hash based on Poly 1305 and another very fast keyed hashing function called NH. We also hash a value called the tweak, which is used to ensure that different sectors are encrypted differently. In fact, the tweak in practice is typically the cluster number. That way, it's called a tweakable block cipher, and each block, the number of the block, the offset of the block in the file system, is the tweak factor, which means that if you were to encrypt the same data in two different places on the drive, it would look completely different and no one could tell it was actually the same. You want to prevent that, even that slight leakage of information. So this is known as a tweakable block cipher, where the tweak adds, you can think of it as like another key to the keyed cipher. They say this hash is then used to generate a nonce for the cha-cha encryption. After encryption, we hash again so that we have the same strength in the decryption direction as the encryption direction. This is arranged in a configuration known as a Feistel network so that we can decrypt what we've encrypted. A single AES-256 invocation on a 16-bit block is also required, but for 4096 inputs, this is not performance critical. So in the show notes, I have a picture of the algorithm showing how it all works. I won't go into it because that was a description of it just now. And they note that cryptographic primitives like ChaCha were organized in rounds, with each round increasing our confidence in security at a cost and speed. To make disk encryption fast enough on the widest range of devices, we've opted to use the 12-round variant of ChaCha rather than the more widely used 20-round variant. For example, the communications protocol, you know, in TLS uses ChaCha 20. Each round vastly increases the difficulty of attack. The 7-round variant of ChaCha was broken in 2008. And though many papers have improved upon this attack, no attack on 8 rounds is known today. And we've got 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So a 5-round pad with each round, as they said, vastly increasing the difficulty. This ratio of rounds used to rounds broken today is actually better for ChaCha 12 than it is currently for AES 256. So higher security margins than AES right now. They said, even though Adiantum is very new, we are in a position to have high confidence in its security. In our paper, we prove that it has good security properties under the assumption that ChaCha 12 and AES 256 are secure. This is standard practice in cryptography. From primitives like ChaCha and AES, we build constructions like XTS, GCM, or Adiantum. Very often, we can offer strong arguments, but not a proof that the primitives are secure, while we can prove that if the primitives are secure, the constructions we build from them must be too. We don't have to make that assumption about NH or poly 1305 hashes. These are proven to have the cryptographic property that they rely on. And finally, Adiantum, as I was mentioning, I think before we began recording, Leo, is named after the genus of the maidenhair fern, which in the Victorian language of flowers, floriography, represents sincerity and discretion.
They're quite beautiful, actually.
And Adiantum is a fern which water runs off of, interestingly. Yeah.
I think they wanted to have it be adamantium, but they didn't know how to spell it, which is the metal in Wolverine's fingers.
Right. That would have been better. It would have been, maybe it was taken. I mean, it's
trademarked probably, so maybe it can't make it adamantium.
Yeah, and maybe they were trying to be close, but not, you know. Sorry. We're talking about the fern.
It's barely pronounceable, to be honest with you. It's not.
I know. You have to really struggle to, you know. Adiantum. I was rehearsing before the podcast. Adiantum.
Well, there you go.
Yes. Yep. So we have a very cool new high performance, low processor requirement cipher mode. Appropriate for block ciphers. And I take my hat off to Google. You know, that's going to be super useful.
They solved a problem they had and quite elegantly.
Yep.
Friends, we've come to the end of this fine show, but not the end of the conversation. You can go right to grc.com. That's Steve's website. Not only get copies of the show and transcripts, you can get SpinRite, the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. You can join the squirrel groups and participate there. There's lots of other great free stuff there. grc.com. We have audio and video of the show at our site, too, of course, twit.tv/SN. We do Security Now on Tuesdays.
about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to, 21:30 UTC. If you want to watch it, just go to twit.tv/live. You can watch or listen live. And if you do that, join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. That's where the other people watching live hang out. But as usual, on-demand versions are the best way to do it. And again, twit.tv/SN. You can listen. You don't have to miss your jazz radio show or anything like that. You can listen at your leisure, at your convenience, and even at high speed, as some people do. I don't blame them.
Okay.
All of our shows sound better. When it's funny, I had somebody come in yesterday or Sunday. I was listening to Twit. He said, "You sound so weird because I listen at double speed almost all the time." You sound a little drunk.
Slow.
This is what we normally sound like. Don't forget our Twit survey, twit.to/survey19. We do this every year to get a better idea of what you're interested in, who you are. It helps us sell advertising. We are not collecting personal information of any kind, don't worry. But it just gives us a general idea of the audience. So twit.to/survey19. Thanks, Steve. Have a great week.
Thank you, my friend. Talk to you next week for episode 702.
Bye.
Security.